Who is thirsty? So now we are taking or following similar steps as in the scalar case. Now comes the modifications. Now we are going to build in an infrared cutoff into the path integral. And at that point, all of a sudden, this useful idea of the background gauge technique has another useful application. Namely, now we shall use this background G bar in order to formulate the mode cutoffs. So what we have up to now is this blue path integral, the H, the integral over the ghosts, classical action, gauge fixing, ghost action. Now we add a piece which we denote delta KS here. Delta KS is the suppression term. It is tailored along the same lines as in the scalar case. It is quadratic in the quantum fields HH, C bar C, and it has a cutoff operator RK for the graviton and for the ghosts. And all both of these operators have the same structure. There is some matrix of numerical constants, then K squared, and then there is a dimensionless function of the covariant Laplacian over K squared. Now, let me make various comments. First of all, these prefactors are, in the case of the ghosts, just some numbers I will fix later on. In the case of the graviton, they have a certain tensorial structure involving nothing but the background metric. Then, the so-called shape function of the cutoff, this R0, is a kind of normalized cutoff function which has the property that it interpolates between 0 for large arguments and 1 for small arguments. So k squared times c is the value of this object at low momenta. So now the next change in the construction as compared to the simple scalar case in flat space is the argument here. What you see here is the covariant Laplacian formed from the background metric, and that covariant Laplacian plays the role of the naive momentum squared in flat space. So it's, in a sense, you organize your modes according to eigenmodes of this covariant Laplacian, and then you suppress those which have covariant eigenmodes with eigenvalues smaller than k, and you do not suppress those which have larger eigenvalues. So p squared in this context is just an abbreviation for the d squared eigenmodes. It has nothing to do with a flat space momentum. So the role of long wavelength versus small wavelength, high frequency versus low frequency modes is the harmonic modes, is a kind of harmonic analysis in the background Laplacian. You have a question?
Yeah, I have a question. When you cut out the action determinant, the H is invariant. So
it is? Yeah, I come to that. Very good, very good. Very good. It is gauge invariant under the background gauge transformations. The background transformations, recall, they change G bar as a tensor, they transform G bar tensorially and H mu nu tensorially. So under the background gauge transformations, this is indeed invariant. And that will be very important later on. And in fact, to make this cutoff background gauge invariant is important, is crucial for getting an effective average action, which is a gauge invariant functional of its argument. That was another important comment. And the last comment is, you could ask, why did you put here a G bar and not the full metric? Why not put here G, which is gamma, let's say gamma plus H, then you would cut off with the eigenmodes of the full metric. The answer is, in that case, the cutoff is no longer quadratic in the quantum fields, HH, C bar C, And that would lead to a flow equation which has a enormously much more complicated structure. The simple structure of this flow equation and all the technical simplifications compared to old-fashioned flow equations which you get here is being quadratic in the quantum field. So there is basically not much you can do, and in the beginning we did a lot of experimentation about getting the optimum, the best choice for this cutoff, and here the background formalism plays a dual role. You have on the one side the old benefits from getting a gauge invariant functional gamma, and the new benefit is you can formulate a quadratic cutoff operator in a covariant way. So that is the new ingredient, and now all the rest, the next transparency we can rush through, that is now the same steps as we did before. You start by adding source terms, h mu nu, you couple to a source little t mu nu, the ghosts, you couple to sources sigma bar and sigma. Then, as always in gauge theories, if you would like to formulate word identities, BRS word identities, it's helpful to couple the BRS variations to sources beta mu nu and tau mu. That's not important, you can forget about this line. Then you define a generating functional, it depends on the sources for the graviton, for the ghosts, on this BRS sources, not important, and very important, it depends on the background. Now the structure is the same, classical gauge fixing, ghost, cutoff, source terms. Then introduce average fields. Little h bar is the expectation value of the fluctuation. H mu nu is up to a determinant formed from the background metric. It's the t mu nu derivative. Of course, t mu nu is reminiscent of energy momentum tensor. The t mu nu derivative of w xi are the expectation values of the ghosts. Then you do a Legendre transformation from the sources, t sigma sigma bar, you go to average fields, h bar, xi xi bar, at fixed BRS sources, and most importantly, fixed background. So this background does not take part in any Legendre transformation, it's just a parameter. In this context, it helps thinking of this G bar dependence. You can think of it as being something like the gauge fixing parameter alpha, for instance. If you forget about the infrared cutoff, just in standard background technology, G bar is a parameter, here a parameter function in the gauge fixing term, and so you might think of this G bar just as a label which labels the kind of gauge fixing term you are using. That's another way to think of this dependence. Well, and then the effective average action as such is defined by the Legendre transform as always, and then the cutoff term with the classical fields inserted is subtracted again. So this is the same recipe as before, and apart from notational difficulties and difficulties in remembering the names of the fields, everything goes as we had it discussed already. Now, the next step, you introduce a classical complete metric. G without a G, without a bar, is the expectation value of gamma. And G, the full G, is the sort of macroscopic version of gamma. G bar is classical, and H bar is the average of H mu nu. Then you have these two choices of writing your action, either this semicolon notation where you have the fluctuation and the background as the argument, or you could also say you have a gamma which depends on two metrics plus the other stuff with, which is not important now. Okay, so this is the definition. And now comes the pleasant surprise, namely by exploiting that both the gauge fixing term and the cutoff term are invariant under the background transformations, background gauge transformations, you can verify that the object gamma k is diffeomorphism invariant in the sense that whenever you change all of the arguments, g, g bar, the ghosts and the sources, by their Lie derivative transform them as tensor fields of the appropriate rank, then gamma is invariant. And that would not obtain for a standard gauge fixing, only for this background version of a gauge fixing you get this nice property. And the standard effective action, that is what people always used in perturbation theory, is the k equals zero limit of this object. That is what David and people were constructing, basically. And in particular, they were looking at the object gamma bar, which obtains by identifying these two metrics. Let's remember what we did for the scalar. We put the classical fluctuation to zero, or we equated the two complete fields. So let's now define the, I don't put the superscript bar here, but a B here. But let's again introduce this gamma bar obtained by putting the two fields equal and for simplicity the other sources to zero. Then this object is what in standard perturbation theory is used as the generating functional of quantum gravity. The statement is it contains all information about physical S matrix elements. By differentiating gamma bar with respect to this field, g mu nu, you can compute all, for instance, graviton-graviton scattering amplitudes you are interested in. And what we are constructing here is basically a scale-dependent analog of that. And this object, this thing here, is depending on just one metric and is invariant under a standard general coordinate transformation. Now, this is by no means trivial. Now, here it really gets non-trivial that the identified functional and the original one generate the same on-shell Green's functions. And this basically is what one could call the magic of the background gauge technique. And let me, in a somewhat symbolic notation, indicate it again here. Why is it non-trivial? The claim is that gamma background, I did not write this background B, the claim is that this functional with the two identical arguments generates a set of one particle irreducible Green's functions which are on shell equivalent to the result from the non-background formalism. Why is it non-trivial? For the following reason, gamma bar is claimed to generate admissible Green's functions by differentiation. Here I've written one differentiation acting upon gamma bar. So gamma bar is the original gamma, which has this, let's call it genuine argument, and it has this background argument. Now if you differentiate gamma bar, you hit this argument and you hit this one. Explicitly, you differentiate the first argument and you also differentiate the second argument. Now, strictly speaking, what you should do to be along the lines of the standard functional integral quantization, strictly speaking, you should keep only this term where you differentiate the true classical field argument. And G bar, I told you, has the logical status of something like a gauge fixing parameter in this context. So this thing here is what you would usually call, or multiple derivative generalizations of it, you would usually call the endpoint function of the theory. But now you get a new term where the derivative hits the background argument. And it is not trivial that, nevertheless, the physics, I'll tell you in a moment what physics means, the physics of this kind of Green's functions and this kind of Green's functions, where you keep these differentiations acting on the background, that they are the same. Now the claim is, and this can be proven, they are indeed the same. And there is a sort of intuitive argument why this is true. I told you this G bar parametrizes the kind of gauge fixing condition you use. Now if you have a physical process, for instance graviton-graviton scattering or gluon-gluon scattering in Yang-Mills theory or something like that, then if you compute a cross-section for that, of course this cross-section better should be gauge independent. In standard calculation you check alpha independence, for instance. In this context it should better be background independent, and there is a standard way of proving that this is really true when you go on shell with your external lines. If you think in terms of Feynman diagrams, then the result, the amputated on-shell Green's functions, they are indeed gauge invariant. And in a similar spirit, you can show that varying the background metric or the background gauge field, this here is something which has no impact when you go on-shell, sort of, when you put your external legs on the Mars shell in these scattering experiments. So in that sense, this second kind of differentiation does not matter. On shell, yes. Off shell, it does not vanish. And off shell, things are different. Changing alpha, you change the off shell Green's functions, and here you change the Green's functions as a functional of G bar, as long as you are not on shell. Well, the intuitive way is to think of it as being just a change of the gauge fixing parameter. And there is, it's fairly easy to prove formally the alpha independence when you go, for instance, when you compute the expectation value of a gauge invariant observable, then you can show that it does not depend on how you gauge fix. And it's a bit more complicated for scattering processes when you go on shell, but in a similar spirit, this is also physics-wise irrelevant. And so this is the standard k equals zero object, and we are computing now a k-dependent version of it. And we are doing this again by means of a flow equation. Well, I don't show you any details now. The details, the derivation of the flow equation is exactly as it was in the scalar case, following the same steps. You can derive this closed form equation for the functional depending on the classical fluctuation, the ghosts, these sources, and the background. This is almost as in classical as in the scalar case, and this is an additional trace coming from the ghosts. Here this R hat notation, this R hat is an operator in the direct direct sum of the Hilbert spaces spent by the fluctuations of the graviton and the ghosts. It has a piece which is the graviton cutoff and the ghost cutoff. And gamma k2 now here everywhere is the Hessian of our functional with respect to h bar and the ghosts, but at fixed beta tau, forget it, and more importantly, at fixed G bar. Now this sounds innocent, but is a problem in principle. Namely, this is now a beautifully general coordinate invariant equation in the sense that if you start, actually here is the infinite K limit, this is the gamma infinity, which you again can derive. It's essentially the classical terms, or if you put h bar to zero, it's really the classical action. When you start at infinity with a classical action, which is diffeomorphism invariant, then this flow will not generate any terms which are non-invariant. And that is what we wanted to achieve. But there is a price to be paid for that, and the price is the functional which we actually evolve here is a functional of two metrics, or equivalently of the background metric and the fluctuation, so effectively two metrics. And this means it's the space of these functionals is much larger than what you naively would think. Two metrics and also the ghosts you need. This beta tau you can forget if you don't like it. But the flow is sort of cannot be reduced to a smaller set of functionals. In particular, setting h bar to zero does not commute with the evolution. You can put the source to zero only after the evolution. And this is obvious from the fact that this Hessian here has to be performed at fixed g bar. You take here, you take derivatives with respect to h bar and the ghost at fixed g bar. And here there is no argument that you can sort of also hit that g bar. That is absolutely forbidden. You have to do it in that sequence, and that's what you have to get used to.
With doesn't the mod cutoff term break the argument that at the end of the day the functional background was before?
No, it does not. I mean, this is because the background, the cutoff term is background gauge invariant, and therefore.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. What it breaks, you are right, is when I evolve this object, that is the complication I mentioned at the end of the classical, the scalar section. What is new here is that RK depends on the background, and therefore this functional is not simply a functional of G bar plus H bar. It is not. That is what you had in mind. And therefore this complication arises, which was not there in the scalar case. Yes, because this RK is... No, it follows because the RKs are all zero at k equals zero. So we are guaranteed to recover the standard gamma at k equals zero. So we are guaranteed that at k equals zero, we get the standard effective action, but you... The flow in between depends, of course, on the choice of the cutoff.
There might be an asymptotic effect when you send the cutoff to zero or to infinity. There's an imprint of the shape of the fact that the cutoff depends on the
shape. Better not know. So without commenting it in any way, just let me show you some ward identities which you can derive from the BRS invariance of the exponent under the path integral. I will not go through it. Just let me mention the left hand side equals to zero. This is the classical ward identities or the standard ward identities for the ordinary effective action. Here you have a gamma prime is gamma minus this classical gauge fixing piece, and this equal to zero is what you find in the old perturbative papers. Now here you get a correction term which in principle involves gamma again. This is an exact relation satisfied by the exact solution to the flow equation, and this can be used, these relations you could use in principle as a tool to judge the quality of approximations. This has been done in Yang-Mills theory, but not yet for gravity. Now this brings me to the, let's say, back to Earth. Up to now, everything was exact in the sense of not having made, it was formal but exact in the sense of having not made any approximations. Now we shall gradually truncate, more and more truncate the space of functionals and then get some explicit examples of flows. First of all, let's look at a very general, still very general class of truncations which we investigated. Namely, assume your full functional has the structure of a gamma k depending on two metrics, g and g bar, and the ghost term and this BRS couplings are kept classical. So the assumption here, this BRS stuff is anyhow not important. The assumption here is you neglect renormalization effects in the ghost sector. This is an assumption. Later on, we shall argue it's plausible or is not totally crazy. And for functionals of this form, the flow equation becomes much simpler. You have two traces then. This is a trace over the Hilbert space of the graviton fluctuations and this over the Hilbert space of the ghost fluctuations. Now these matrices are block diagonal and these two pieces decouple. M is the Fadeev-Popov operator I had shown before. And now in this class of approximations, let me make an even stronger assumption. Namely, let me now make a very simple assumption inspired by a classical general relativity. That was the first example I had worked out, namely the so-called, or what one could call Einstein-Hilbert truncation. Just inspired by the fact that classical general relativity is, or a classical gravity is nicely described according to all we know by the Einstein-Hilbert action, let us use this classical action as an inspiration. It's not more than that, just as an inspiration for a sensible truncation ansatz. This Einstein-Hilbert truncation simply amounts to retaining just two types of invariants, so it's a two-dimensional truncation. You put a prefactor set here in front of everything, then you have a square root g times r term, and you have a cosmological constant term. Instead of the constant cosmological constant, you have a k-dependent one, and the prefactor is the Newton constant, kappa squared that I had defined earlier, is essentially 1 over 8 pi times g bar, which is a real constant. So kappa is something like the Planck mass, that's a constant mass scale, which is expressed in terms of this g bar. So what this ansatz amounts to is you allow the Newton constant and the cosmological constant to be scale dependent. You assume for any value of k, the gamma of g and g bar has this structure. And for the gauge fixing term, we use also the classical form with this prefactor. And I emphasize this is just for mathematical simplicity and inspired by classical physics. It's a first guess, but I'm neither claiming that this is a good approximation at Planckian energies or beyond, nor I am claiming that this is a good approximation macroscopically. Well, it's a good approximation within the experimental errors, as we know, but beyond there might be additional terms. Let's just look what happens. You had a question?
No, this is a crucial point. So I just want to understand exactly. Distinguish a truncation from an approximation. So you are...
It's synonymous. A truncation is in the best of all worlds, it is an approximation. So the philosophy is you try some basis monomials, you determine the flow. Then what you should do is add more and more terms make the subspace large, and then in principle you should verify that the results you get from the simpler truncation stabilize. Yes, yes.
So this is, I guess the correct question I suppose is the distinction between approximation and a nonsense. It's not a nonsense in the sense that this class is perhaps certain number of terms could be a complete thing. This is certainly an approximation.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. That is absolutely clear, yes. No doubts on that, and I'm also, of course, I'm not claiming that this is a good approximation at k equals zero. That even exactly, it is just the contrary of what people in perturbation theory would say. For us, this, I hope to convince you, this is a good approximation when k is very large, and not so good an approximation when k becomes small. But about validity or not, let's forget about the moment whether all that makes sense or not. Let's just do this kind of calculation I described in the scalar case. So the technical task is you, first of all, you insert this on the left-hand side. I'm always confused. The left-hand side then involves square root g times r, derivative of znk, n is for Newton, and then dt z lambda bar is the second prefactor of square root g. And then you have this problem. First of all, you have to do this Hessian, take the derivative with respect to g at fixed g bar, then you get some operators under the trace, and then you have to expand them, do a kind of derivative expansion and retain only those two terms. And what you need are these red pieces here. These red pieces are providing the beta functions later on. Well, the rest is in principle straightforward. What you do is, first of all, you take this functional, you want to know the Hessian. You can say, I look at the piece when I expand about h bar, I need the second order term in the Taylor series, and its kernel is the Hessian. So h bar in between some kernel, which involves the background metric and the background Ricci and Riemann tensor, here also lambda. So this object here is what appears under the trace. Now the next step, just to diagonalize these tensorial structures and to continue the calculation. For the next step, it's useful to decompose the metric fluctuation into a traceless part and a trace piece. H hat, by definition, has vanishing trace with respect to G bar. So that is innocent. And now comes a conceptually important point, which is often misinterpreted. Namely, what we would like to do is to identify terms proportional to square root g and square root g times r in the derivative expansion. And for doing that, you can insert any kind of special metric which distinguishes these two invariants, which gives special values, different values to these invariants. And what we do here is we insert a maximally symmetric background, a sphere. And this is conceptually, this is the same as inserting a constant field in the case of the local potential approximation for the scalar case. This has nothing to do with studying flows in De Sitter space or something like that, or on Euclidean spheres. This is just a technical tool, and if you would be willing to work much harder, you could forget about this thing and do it everything just by standard derivative expansion techniques. So this simplification of inserting a maximally symmetric background with this Riemann tensor is just of a technical nature and does not mean any restriction to the applicability or validity of the beta functions we get. So, well, first of all, now I come to another tricky point. Then pulling out the trace part from the quadratic form, things become pretty simple. You have h hat, this is the quadratic traceless part with this operator in between CT is a certain function of the space-time dimension. And then you have the trace part phi with the second order operator in between. R bar is the constant curvature on that sphere we use. And then there is this prefactor. This is the famous prefactor in front of the kinetic term of the conformal mode you all know, which has this infamous property of being negative. I think now I'm running out of laser power. This is this term which is negative, gives a wrong sign kinetic term to the to the conformal factor, to the trace part of the metric. Now this means if you just think of this as the classical action where, I think it works again. Oh, okay. Thank you. If you think in terms of the classical action, you have the same, exactly the same phenomenon here. In the classical action, if you pull out the phi, you have a plus and then phi and a positive operator in between. This is a very famous problem related to the Einstein-Hilbert action. There are these arguments or recipes, analytic continuations and so on to cure this problem. This is a problem I should mention typical of this Einstein-Hilbert action. And what I am now trying to convince you of is that even though the path integral has this difficulty, the flow equation does not have any difficulty if you choose these set factors in an appropriate way. So the claim is even in presence of a problem of an instability of this form, the flow equation is well defined even though the path integral from which it formally was derived, just formally, is not well defined. And this, the logic is as follows. So the point I have not yet explained to you is how to choose these numerical constants in front of the cutoff term, this calligraphic set case. If you take any field mode, whatever it is, it has a cutoff term of this sort. This is the normalized cutoff, which is unity for low frequency modes. And then you have a k squared times this constant. Now, what you would like to happen is that for all modes, when they get long wavelength or large or low momentum, then you would like that this acts as a mass term. So if your inverse propagator in the truncation has some constant theta in front of a p squared, say in the simplest case, then you would like that this term and this term combines to some constant, and then you would like to get for every mode a propagator of the kind p squared plus k squared for p small. And this gives you the general rule. Namely, the rule is you should, in this simple situation at least, you should choose these calligraphic sets equal to theta, and then the suppression factor in the path integral has this form. This is most appropriately chosen to be that prefactor. Now, this works fine as long as theta is positive. But what do you do for negative values of theta? And that's precisely the situation for the conformal factor. Now, my claim is that even in this case, you should continue to use this identification and should put a set equals to theta, even though this might look paradoxical, because it would mean that if this is negative, naively, this seems to indicate that your so-called suppression factor does not suppress the infrared, but rather enhances it. Now, there are two possible or various possible attitudes towards this problem. Well, first of all, one justification for this rule is that it gives the correct perturbative propagators. I told you in the very first transparency, in perturbation theory, you would like a propagator 1 over p squared plus k squared. And if you put the relative plus between these two terms, if you adopt this rule, then you get these propagators and you do get the correct infrared cutoff in perturbation theory, while the choice which would lead to a suppression, the other one, z equals minus theta, would give a minus sign between p squared and k squared, which generates a spurious pole at p equals k. And this is certainly not what you want. This is not an infrared regularization. So this is clearly nonsense, even though it would naively correspond to a damping. So this you should not do. So one attitude could be you are not trying to make the path integral well defined. It's just formal. It generates the flow equation, and what you really define and what really defines your theory is just the flow equation. That's the attitude you could adopt, for instance, in Euclidean space. Now, for the Lorentzian case, the situation is a bit different, namely, in the Lorentzian case, you don't have a minus sign here, but an I. And the suppression takes place not by a decaying exponential, but by an oscillatory exponential, very rapid oscillations by something like the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma leads to the damping and to the suppression. And in this case, this does not matter at all whether you have one sign or the other sign does not matter at all. So at this point, there might be really the dividing line between Lorentzian versus Euclidean quantum gravity. If it should really be true that in the exact treatment there is such a conformal factor problem, then this might indicate that you should work in Lorentzian signature only and that perhaps the Euclidean theory makes no sense. But this is not known. We don't know, that's the crucial remark, we don't know whether this problem is a problem of the truncation or whether it's a problem of the theory as such. What could happen is that if you go to higher orders, more complicated truncations, that you will not encounter these problems, that there is no conformal factor instability. And in fact, later on, I will show you a more complicated example of a truncation where there is indeed no such instability. Yes? Yes. No, this could simply disappear because the statement would be for no value of k, gamma k is very close to this Einstein-Hilbert form. And that is, of course, not in contradiction with any observation.
But I thought that you, okay, you
I'm not claiming that Einstein-Hilbert is good anywhere. There could be non-local terms stabilizing this conformal factor, or there could be all sorts of modifications.
Okay, so you're not taking Einstein-Hilbert as your initial, as gamma infinity?
No.
So what is your initial data? Or up to the right initial data? The way you were presenting so far, that you were putting as your initial data some classical action.
I will use this as an intermediate. I mean, first of all, you can think of Einstein-Hilbert as being valid at some intermediate. I'm using it everywhere from infinity to zero, and you will see that everything works well even if gamma infinity is Einstein-Hilbert. Then there is this problem, but I will also present another truncation including an R squared term, and it does not have this problem.
Mm-hmm. So, a priori, this, you know, usual trinity of this axiom is maybe positive. So you expect some stability.
Right, right.
Whereas here, the problem might show up in the fact that this axiom now, changes size.
Right.
So that the flow, so it's not clear why the flow equation won't fit.
Yes. Yes, and in fact, there is no, there is no, and also it does not lead to a particularly unstable behavior. I will show you what the differences are. I guess I should stop in a moment, and in 30 seconds there is an ideal point for a break. Just let me now show you the flow equations, which we shall discuss the next time. So what we really do is to use this matrix of z factors. This is the projector on the trace path. There you have this set, and for the trace path, for the conformal factor, you use a relatively negative prefactor. So this is the recipe I told you. And now with this definition of the set factors, everything is defined. The technical problem is to evolve certain traces over symmetric traceless tensors, vectors, scalars, and so on. That can be done in this simple example with standard heat kernel techniques. And let me just show you the result. Namely, the answer is now a system of two coupled equations for little gk is the dimensionless version of Newton's constant. You multiply by an appropriate power of the cutoff. Capital GK is this constant times the set factor. So this GK is the renormalized running Newton constant, the dimension full one. This is the dimensionless one. And little lambda without the bar is the dimensionless cosmological constant. So here you divide by two powers of k. And then what you get is two ordinary differential equations. The first one is dt gk, so k d dk g. The right-hand side is the beta function. This beta function has a d minus 2, then it has a so-called anomalous dimension piece and an explicit g. The anomalous dimension is the logarithmic derivative of this set. It has this explicit formula where these b's involve, the b's, b1, b2, are functions of the dimensionless cosmological constant. Here is the lambda, explicit factors of the dimension, and then there are what we call threshold functions phi and phi tilde. They are defined by integrals of this type. The black thing is phi, and the phi tilde does not have this term here. They are known once you fix a shape function. So then these phis are known for specific choices of R0. You can compute them explicitly. So this is the first beta function, and already at this point I can easily see that this result, even though it stems from a very trivial truncation, is non-perturbative, because here you have a little g in the denominator. If you would do a perturbation theory in Newton's constant, you would more or less compute a power series in little g, and if you expand this expression here, you get arbitrarily high powers in little g. So what this formalism does is to sum up arbitrarily high perturbative powers. So this is the first part of the system of equations, and the second part has a similar structure involving the same kind of threshold functions here. This is the scale dependence of lambda, again phi phi tilde, explicitly the eta. So this equation and the other one, two coupled equations for the scale dependence of Newton's constant and the cosmological constant. And next time we shall then discuss what the flow really looks like and generalizations of it. Thank you.